Welcome to the Georgia Today podcast from GPB News. Today is Friday, November 8th. I'm Peter Biello. On today's episode, Georgia Democrats look to recalibrate after Tuesday night's election. State lawmakers reconsider how to plan for natural disasters. And a new biography profiles the life and legacy of civil rights hero John Lewis. These stories and more are coming up on this edition of Georgia Today. Georgia Democrats are looking to recalibrate after Tuesday's election. So far, results show Democrats didn't narrow GOP majorities in the state legislature as much as they'd hoped. Democrats will gain 2 seats in the state House, while the party makeup will stay the same in the state Senate. One of the Republican to Democratic flips will make 23-year-old Bryce Berry the youngest ever member of the state House.
We had a message, didn't work out. Now it's time to go back. It's time to get our heels in the ground and fight harder and tailor our message even better so that voters can accepted in 2026 and 2028.
Bryce will represent a district in Atlanta. How does he see the Democrats recalibrating?
But we have to be investing in things like coalition organizing and youth organizing year-round. So we're not only showing up in election year to ask people for their vote, but we're showing up and asking people, are they okay?
Democrats will pick new minority leaders in both chambers after their current leaders announced their retirements earlier this year. Georgia State Senate Republicans nominated Senator John Kennedy of Macon last night for president pro tem, a vote that signals they'll likely stick with their same leadership team for the next 2 years. The full Senate will vote on the post when it convenes for a new term in January. With Republicans retaining the same 33-23 majority as the last term, Kennedy is likely to win that vote. After the vote, Kennedy reaffirmed that the Senate Republican caucus will maintain close links with Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones, a fellow Republican and former state senator. Kennedy says he wants to see continued tax relief and a solution to chronic absenteeism in schools, a problem that has lingered since the COVID-19 pandemic. After winning a decisive victory in the race for district attorney in Georgia's Western District, independent Kalki Yalamanchili is preparing to take office on January 1st. Yalamanchili defeated Democrat Deborah Gonzalez with nearly 60% of the vote. The district covers Clark and Oconee counties. Yalamanchili ran on the message of removing partisanship from the DA's office and hiring enough prosecutors to handle the caseload. He says he's working on hiring more prosecutors now.
Our plan is to fully staff that office with experienced prosecutors, and then, you know, to the extent that we have newer, younger prosecutors, they will then have mentors and more experienced attorneys that can train them on how to do the job.
Gonzalez had faced legal reprimands for not communicating with victims about cases and was sued for violating open records laws, criticism she called distractions from her office's accomplishments, which included expunging people's records, resentencing 5 people, and referring 15 juveniles to restorative justice programs. Rudy Giuliani says he is the victim of a political vendetta and believes the judgment against him in favor of 2 Georgia election workers could be reversed. The former lawyer for President-elect Trump has been ordered to turn over assets, including a car and a watch, as part of a $148 million defamation judgment. The courts say the assets are due to 2 Georgia election workers, Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss, whom Giuliani defamed by spreading lies about their involvement in election fraud. Giuliani's lawyers have so far argued unsuccessfully that Giuliani should not be forced to turn over his belongings while he appeals the judgment. Giuliani also maintains that he did not defame the election workers, who say they faced death threats after Giuliani accused them of counting ballots multiple times and tampering with voting machines. Asked whether he might join the incoming Trump administration, Giuliani says he would if that's what Trump wants. State lawmakers have been tasked with considering how Georgia should move forward on planning for natural disasters. The Senate Subcommittee on Disaster Mitigation and Resilience held its first meeting earlier this week in an Atlanta suburb after being postponed by Hurricane Helene. GPB's Sophie Gratis has more.
Georgia's current response to natural disasters is spread across a variety of players, like emergency management and natural resource agencies. Now, lawmakers are considering a different option, creating and funding a statewide response team, or outsourcing that work to private companies. It's something other states have done with success, says UGA professor Brian Bledsoe. And as floods and extreme temperatures become more common in the South, Bledsoe told lawmakers random acts of kindness will not be enough.
And a lot of people talk about, well, we need capacity. It's a lot of things. It's people that can write grants. It's staff embedded across sectors. And it's some state-level guiding vision for resilience.
It will be up to elected officials to approve that vision in order to help prepare for disasters before they happen. For GPB News, I'm Sophie Gratis.
MARTA is planning a groundbreaking next week for a project expected to generate 700 construction jobs and 400 permanent jobs. The Clayton County Operations and Multipurpose Facility will support both diesel and battery electric buses for the county's expanding transit system. MARTA secured $33 million in federal funding for this project through the Federal Transit Administration, as well as a $5 million earmark obtained by Senator Raphael Warnock, and it's also directed $5.6 million in FTA formula grants to support the project. Retailer American Freight is closing all of its 328 stores, including 15 in Georgia. The closures come as the result of a Chapter 11 bankruptcy plan. Parent company Franchise Group said American Freight had struggled due to sustained inflation and macroeconomic challenges facing the large durable goods sector. During the store closing sales, select American Freight financing and delivery services will remain available to customers. Sea turtles in coastal Georgia had a slow nesting season this year, but experts say a busy season is on the horizon. GPB's Benjamin Payne reports.
About 2,500 loggerhead nests were recorded along Georgia's beaches throughout the season, which runs from May through October. That's about 1,000 fewer than last year. The drop was expected, though, because sea turtle nesting tends to come in predictable waves. Biologist Mark Dodd is with the Georgia Department of Natural Resources and oversees the state's Sea Turtle Conservation Program.
The good news is that the overall trend in nesting over the last 36 years is that population is increasing at about 4% annually. It indicates that we're in a recovery period for loggerheads.
Dodd attributes the long-term success of the species to conservation measures begun in the 70s and 80s. He says next year is likely to bring a busy nesting season similar to 2022, when Georgia saw about 4,000 sea turtle nests. For GPB News, I'm Benjamin Payne in Savannah.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
Georgia's very own John Lewis rose from abject poverty to become what many called the conscience of the civil rights movement in Congress. A new biography tells his story in what the Atlanta Journal-Constitution calls a, quote, danger-filled coming-of-age adventure chronicled in sweeping detail by David Greenberg. He teaches history and journalism at Rutgers University and wrote John Lewis, A Life, released last month. He spoke to GPB's Orlando Montoya.
David Greenberg, how did Lewis rise through the civil rights movement to become a leader?
It's really a remarkable story how John Lewis emerges as a leader in the movement, because in so many ways, he wasn't the type you would necessarily mark for leadership. He came from a rural Alabama background. He spoke with a thick rural accent and a bit of a stammer. When he got to the American Baptist Theological Seminary in Nashville, not itself not a particularly big place, even there he seemed kind of a bit of an outsider, pure hick, his friend Bernard Lafayette said. And he was shy. He lacked a certain amount of self-confidence. And yet within a short time, certain natural leadership qualities emerged in him. He was thoughtful. He was attentive to others. And maybe above all, he was deeply and wholly committed to the ideals of Gandhian and Martin Luther King style nonviolence that became the movement's philosophy.
How did Lewis handle moments of despair and vulnerability, such as when he was ousted as leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was around the same time that Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy were assassinated?
It's a low moment for him. The civil rights movement, and in particular SNCC, the organization he led, has moved away from the ideals of nonviolence and interracial cooperation toward a more Black separatist philosophy. Lewis leaves Atlanta, spends a sort of unhappy year in New York City. One person who makes a big difference in his life at this point is Lillian Miles. Lillian was a woman he had just started dating, and she visits him. He's actually in the hospital for exhaustion, maybe even depression. And Lillian sort of comes along, gives him love and attention, and helps him sort of believe in himself again. And at that point, they decide to get married. And for the rest of his life, and I think this is not fully appreciated, I think it's something my book tries to make clear and shed light on, Lillian really becomes a big source of ambition, inspiration, and support for him as he goes on to pursue what turns out to be a very successful career in politics.
Lewis was called the conscience of the Congress, but he was elected to Congress and displayed some of the opportunism and politics that that institution is known for. Can you talk about those chapters in the book and why you felt they're important in understanding Lewis?
Well, I think John Lewis, you know, had two very important parts of his life, and I sort of call them book one, protest, and book two, politics. Now, sometimes politics does require people to be opportunistic, to place winning ahead of maybe a purely principled stand. But I don't see that at all as a negative quality in John Lewis. I think he did stick to his principles. His title of the conscience of Congress was very much deserved. And yet, nobody gets anywhere simply by, you know, articulating the same principles over and over. You also have to work to make change, and that's why people elect you. So he learned to be a good congressman and sort of bring home the bacon for his district, helping Atlanta with airport funding and highway funding that helped make it the big, dynamic, entrepreneurial city that it was becoming. In his race against his friend Julian Bond, really his best friend, he understood that sometimes you have to go negative in politics. And he decided, after some reluctance, to use the issue of Julian Bond's cocaine use as an issue in that campaign, even though it was unpleasant to raise.
Now, you had a living subject to work with until 2020, but you also had hundreds of other interviews, Lewis's FBI files, and an unfinished biography of Lewis by Lewis's friend and fellow activist Archie Allen. What source surprised you the most?
Well, I should say a word about these materials from Archie Allen. His is probably not a name many people know. He was in Atlanta for many years. He worked with John Lewis in the Carter years and before that at the Voter Education Project in Atlanta. Archie began a biography, never finished it, of Lewis, and collected all kinds of materials, both from Lewis himself and from all kinds of friends, family members, many people long now deceased. And so his willingness to share those boxes and boxes of materials with me was really just a huge asset. But there were also wonderful one-off interviews that I was able to do. Being able to interview President Clinton, President Obama, Hillary Clinton, Nancy Pelosi, all of these people worked closely with him. And their relationship with John Lewis was such that they really had distinct personal memories of him that added a certain depth and detail that I think readers will be surprised and interested to read about.
Your biography comes back again and again to a poem by William Ernest Henley called Invictus, which ends in the line, "I am the captain of my soul." Why that poem?
This story I find completely fascinating, almost uncanny. As a young boy, again, just a farm boy in rural Alabama in the 1940s, John Lewis learned this poem, I guess at school, and would recite it around the house. His brothers and sisters kind of made fun of him because he loved this poem so much. Amazingly, its lines about, I'm forgetting now the exact words, but under the bludgeonings of fate, it talks about being beaten and bludgeoned, which of course is exactly what happens to John Lewis at Selma, but on several occasions in those civil rights years. It's almost as though, you know, he kind of saw his future as someone who was going to endure physical violence as a path toward both self-mastery and social change. And then later in life, it remains a favorite poem. He teaches it to his staff in the office. They often have fun reciting it together. It was recited at his funeral by a young boy, a friend of his. So it really meant a lot to John Lewis, and I think captures something about his indomitable spirit.
David Greenberg teaches history and journalism at Rutgers University and wrote John Lewis, A Life. Thanks for talking to me.
Great, my pleasure. Thank you.
That was GPB's Orlando Montoya with David Greenberg, whose book is the subject of the latest Narrative Edge. That's GPB's podcast, where Orlando and I talk about books with Georgia connections. A new episode comes out every 2 weeks. Find it at gpb.org/narrativeedge or wherever you get your podcasts. And that's it for this edition of Georgia Today. Thank you so much for tuning in this week, busy week of news. If you want to learn more about any of these stories or check for the latest updates, go to gpb.org/news. And if you've got feedback, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email. That's the best way to reach us. The email address is georgiatoday@gpb.org. And don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. Every weekday afternoon, you'll hear an update from us, except for holidays, of course. Monday is one holiday, Veterans Day, that we will take off, but we'll be back with you on Tuesday. So when you subscribe, we will pop up automatically in your feed on Tuesday afternoon. Thanks again for listening. I'm Peter Biello. We'll see you next week.